Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Francis Fukuyama, who is a senior fellow at Stanford University. His new book is The Origins of Political Order. Francis, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Chicago, but I basically grew up in New York City.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
Well, I think probably the reason I'm an academic is because of them. My father was a professor, and my grandfather on my father's side was actually a fairly prominent economist and university president in Japan, and so it seemed to me it was almost foreordained that I'd end up, getting a PhD and going into a university.
And your father's work was in religious studies.
Yes, although he was trained as an empirical sociologist, so I actually inherited his collection of Max Weber and Emil Durkheim books, so that tradition lives on.
And it was a good start for you. Was there discussion of world events and politics and international affairs at the dinner table?
Yes, well, definitely. My political views were different from his. He was always actually a lot more liberal than I was, and so we'd have lots of arguments over, a whole range of subjects after I got to university.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
I went to Cornell.
And at Cornell, were there any teachers that you had who influenced you?
Well, yes. Probably the most important was Alan Bloom, the political theorist. That's why I became a classics major, so I could learn Greek and read Plato and Aristotle. And, he shaped my interest in Western philosophy, I think, very deeply. And it's a background that I really I'm very happy I had.
And then you went on to graduate school at Harvard.
Yes.
And what led to the switch from classics philosophy to political science?
Well, I took this detour in the early 70s when I was in college. Postmodernism hit the U.S. in a big way. And so I actually spent a year in Paris studying with Jacques Derrida and Roland Barthes and, folks like that. Actually, having studied with them and read their books, I decided it wasn't for me. And so I had this kind of reaction where I went in a much more practical direction and ended up doing international relations at Harvard in the Harvard Government Department.
And who there were influential in your education?
My dissertation advisors were Nadav Safran and Adam Ulam, who did Middle East and Soviet studies, respectively. And then that's also where I met Samuel Huntington, who was in the Carter administration for much of my period there, but it come back, and so we intersected, and he was probably the second, after Bloom, probably the second important influence over my intellectual development.
And what was special about Huntington? Was it the power of his mind, mm-hmm. And the problems that he grappled with?
Well, I think so. I think that, the trouble with a lot of academics is that they focus on really narrow issues and they use a lot of jargon, and it's very hard to actually relate it to any real problems. Huntington was just the opposite. He always picked big issues. The other thing was his scope, because he wrote within political science on a whole range of topics. So that included comparative politics and development, national security issues, civil-military relations, and then later on, about religion. And so I think the range of his interest was really quite astonishing.
How important was the fact that he wrote and also was involved in policy issues? That is, that he theoretically focused on issues mm-hmm. that had policy implications.
Well, it was quite important. I think that it meant that his theory was always grounded in an appreciation for real-world political issues. And, I think a lot of what you do when you study policy is you realize what your limitations are. As a pure theorist, you can imagine all sorts of possible worlds that would be great to live in, but you can't actually get there. And I think, having that realistic sense was quite important.
Now, your dissertation was on international relations. Yes. What in particular?
At that time, I was a specialist in Soviet foreign policy, and I focused on Soviet foreign policy in the Middle East. It's a topic that's completely disappeared. So I had to find something else to do in life after that.
And then after completing your degree at Harvard, you went where?
Well, I bounced back and forth. I was in the State Department a couple of times on the policy planning staff. And then my first job was with the think tank, the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, where I also did Soviet, basically analyzed Soviet foreign policy.
And it was in between RAND and the State Department when you wrote the essay, The End of History, that created such an impact. And talk a little about the circumstances and the setting historically that, that led you to write that piece, which really became an international phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was actually working on a couple of RAND projects on the changes going on inside the Soviet Union, not in foreign policy, but just Gorbachev and Perestroika, Glasnost, these big developments in the late 1980s. And at one point, I read a speech of Gorbachev's in which he said, well, the essence of socialism is competition. And at that point, I called up one of my political theorist friends and I said, look, this is the end of history if Gorbachev is saying that socialism amounts to competition. There's really no meaningful difference between us and them. The end of history, of course, referring to the Hegelian Marxist view that history or the end as a goal or a direction rather than a termination. And that's the moment. You know, at some point, I conceived of writing this article as I was on my way out of RAND and into the first Bush administration as a State Department policy planner.
Now, you were 26 years old at about this time.
Well, no, the first time I was at that point, I was in my 30s.
You were okay. So were you surprised by the reaction or?
Well, of course, I expected a few of my specialist friends would read it, and yeah, so I wasn't prepared at all for the reaction. You know, it was just a remarkable time because this was 1989. When the whole world changed so dramatically, and I think it was the conjunction of having anticipated that change by a few months and being able to put it in a larger context that really set off this big discussion.
And looking back, what enabled you to have these insights? What was it? The background in theory and philosophy that you think put you in a position to see the larger picture?
Well, okay, so the references to Hegel and to this French-Russian philosopher Alexandre Kojève, who was just extremely important in France during the 1930s and 40s, I think allowed me to have a more theoretical view of, you know, the problem of history itself. But I think actually what did it for me was just paying attention to contemporary politics because things were happening very, very rapidly in the Soviet Union. I remember at the time going to various conferences of Soviet specialists, and in a sense they're so wedded to a certain view of, you know, the way that political system worked that when they saw things, you know, changing, they just didn't believe that was happening, and they couldn't take aboard, this new reality. And so I think, you know, in a sense, just this willingness to, you know, look at the facts as they unfold on the ground, and being able to adjust that, given your own priors and prejudices, I think was important.
Now, looking back at that work, events have happened after the writing of that initial essay, and of course the essay was misinterpreted. People were saying, "Oh, he's saying history is over. Mm-hmm. There are not going to be any more historical events," which wasn't what you were saying at all. And so, what have you learned from both the reaction and the way the world has changed since?
Well, I guess from the reaction, I guess it's just, you know, there's a kind of limit in public discourse as to, you know, the degree to which you can bring in serious philosophical ideas. I think the more important question is about the way the world has changed, because obviously a lot has happened in terms of you know, what Huntington called the third wave of democratization. This is a period that began in the 1970s with Southern Europe and went on through Latin America, then the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, where a lot of the world became democratic. I think that the thing that I took away from that whole period that is reflected in my new book on political order is the importance of institutions and the fact that, you know, these initial transitions to democracy actually don't yield stable democracy unless you have institutions. And without a state, without a government that can actually enforce rules, without, you know, rule of law that's really rooted in a set of legal institutions, it's very hard to sustain a democratic practice. And I think the difficulty of getting to that point is something that I probably initially underestimated.
Before we talk about the book, let me ask you this question. What do you think is the skill set that enables a scholar, a thinker, to be able to confront these very great changes, you know, in the world and think about them in a rigorous, systematic way?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's complicated. I, you know, had basically a humanities background rather than a social science background. I didn't spend a lot of time early on doing quantitative methods and so forth. And I, you know, the humanities is not in great shape in modern academia, but I think that's too bad, because I actually think that confronting, you know, great thinkers of the past and understanding the world, you know, through their perspectives actually allows you to put things into a much broader context that than you get from the kind of pre-professional, compartmentalized ways that universities tend to teach subjects. And so I think that, you know, I'm really glad that I had a liberal arts, you know, a broad liberal arts education when I was an undergraduate.
A good example of that point seems to be in both in The End of History and then in this new book. You talk about the concept of recognition, which had emerged out of Hegel, which actually seems critical in these times, that one
That's
has
right.
to see that important. Talk a little about that. I mean, because that is an idea that one doesn't find often in the literature on public policy
That's
issues.
Right. Well, you know, the economists think that everybody is basically motivated by material self-interest, but recognition is something different. Recognition is between you and another person. That person's recognition of your status and your dignity as a human being. And if you think about it, a huge part of our modern politics is about the politics of recognition. So I'm a woman, a gay, a Ukrainian nationalist. All of these identities are things that, you know, in the past were undervalued. Ukraine wasn't an independent nation. You know, women were held in subordinate positions. And a lot of the demands in politics are actually not so much demands for material resources as demands for recognition. And I think, you know, you look at what happened in Tunisia with this vegetable seller, Mohamed Bouazizi, who tried to, you know, he had his vegetable cart confiscated. He complained to the authorities. They didn't do anything. He was slapped by a policeman, insulted. And, you know, essentially the regime was not recognizing his status as a citizen. You know, it was treating him as a nobody. And so I think that that's what provoked this enormous anger over offended dignity. And I think, you know, much of human politics has been driven by this kind of anger and the desire that political systems recognize our basic status and worth as human beings.
Now, building on this tradition of Huntington and also on the tradition of your own work and then, you know, events, what is the problem in political development that you wanted to answer with your new book, which is, let me show it again, The Origins of Political Order?
Well, in a sense, especially living here in the United States, we take politics and political institutions for granted. In fact, we've got this anti-statist tradition in the United States where we don't like the government, we don't trust it, we wish it would go away or get smaller or whatnot. And we don't appreciate the fact that it's actually important to have a state, and not every country has that. So you go to a place like, you know, Somalia or Afghanistan or Haiti, you know, the reason that they are so disorganized and chaotic is that they don't have a basic state that can enforce laws. And I think, you know, I've been working in development issues, you know, for some time, and I think there's a general recognition now that the reason that most poor countries in the world are poor is not necessarily that they lack resources, but that they don't have good institutions. They don't have property rights. They don't have a state that can maintain order. You know, Nigeria, for example, has had, I don't know, hundreds of billions of dollars in oil revenues over the past generation, and it's had declining incomes because of the level of corruption and the failure of, you know, the Nigerian state to actually deliver good services to its population. And so in thinking about all of this, I said, well, okay, so where does the state come from? And where do these basic, you know, things come from? As a political scientist, you'd think that there'd be a textbook that you could open up that would explain all of this. And I, you know, I don't think that, you know, that kind of a straightforward account existed. And so that's part of the reason I decided that, you know, I'd have to write one myself.
And importantly, what you're trying to see politics and political development as autonomous, and then asking, right, how do we account for three institutions that are central to the establishment of liberal democracy, which harkens back to your end of history essay, because there you were saying, well, this is the world view, that is liberal democracy, that would triumph.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, so the three institutions are the state itself, the rule of law, and political accountability. And I think part of the miracle of modern politics is that you can get states that are really about power and the use of power, but that are simultaneously limited by law and limited by political accountability. And so the question is, how do you account for the emergence of these three in a single package? And I think that, you know, Huntington's original, his first book, Political Order in Changing Societies, was written in 1968. And from that, I drew the single important lesson that political institutions, you know, have their own internal logic. They may be related to economic development and to social change, but they're not the same thing. They're not, so in other words, modernization is not one total package, and the political parts of it really need to be broken out. And so that's really the issue. Where does the state, rule of law, and political accountability, what was, you know, their historical origin?
Now, in addition to being rich, very rich in history and looking at history in comparative terms, you draw on biological insights, the insights of biological theory for understanding political institutions. That's kind of new. That's kind of very important. And it is through biology that you help us understand the importance of kinship. Mm-hmm. And patrimonialism and so on. Explain that, yeah, to our audience, because that is key to the evolution of the state.
Well, sure. So I think that one of the big revolutions in biology over the last 50 years is the restoration of a belief in human nature. If you go back to the mid-20th century, most social scientists would have said human behavior is completely socially constructed. Human beings are almost infinitely plastic. You know, biology counts for nothing. And I think one of the consequences of the whole genetic revolution and what we've learned about evolutionary biology suggests that that's actually not true, that all human beings actually share certain faculties, cognitive faculties, you know, the faculty for language. The two that are the most important, I think, in politics have to do with sociability. And so one is the principle of what biologists call kin selection, where we're altruistic in proportion to the genes that we share. So in other words, nepotism is biologically rooted. And then the other principle of reciprocal altruism, which in which we exchange favors on a direct face-to-face basis with friends, essentially. So friends and family are a bedrock of human sociability. Every primitive society, they're bonded in this fashion. And part of the default nature of human politics is we go back to friends and families in the absence of modern institutions that make us behave in different ways. And so I think understanding that biological foundation is absolutely critical.
And also as products of our nature, we essentially look for rules, right?
We look for rules. We are rule-following and rule-creating animals. Rules are related to the ability to cooperate socially. If you don't have rules, you can't cooperate. And the reason that they're now, 6 billion human beings on Earth compared to other species is that human beings are able to cooperate on a large scale, and that's where they derive their survival success. And so the generation of rules is something, again, that human beings don't need to be taught. The actual content of the rules, like don't eat pork or respect your ancestors, those are variable, but the faculty for creating rules and the emotions that are associated with rule following and rule breaking are absolutely biologically grounded.
And then finally, the propensity for violence, basically.
Unfortunately, that's, I think, been one of the big drivers of human progress because in essence, we learn to cooperate in order to compete with other human groups. Part of the reason that we've got these enormous, brains compared to other primates is I think, the requirements of social cooperation in competition with other groups of human beings. And you can see this at every step in the development of social complexity, that it's the need to compete over security, military competition that has driven the evolution of more and more complex forms of social organization.
So we're walking through the building blocks of your book, and history is there, the biological basis of human nature, but also the whole power of ideas in moving history.
Human beings have this tremendous capacity, again, a natural capacity for abstraction. So we are constantly imagining invisible forces that explain, behavior in the real world. So today, these invisible forces are things like gravity or, the laws of physics. In the past, they tended to be religious ideas about gods or spirits that explained, why the sun came up in the morning, why, you won a battle. And I think that without this ability to abstract, we wouldn't be able to master the world in the way that that we do. Other primates don't generate abstract ideas about causation and theories about causation, but human beings do that. And that's, the basis of religion, basically. All human societies have religious ideas, except for maybe modern Western Europeans that now think that they're beyond that. But it is a clear characteristic of the way human beings understand the world.
If I compare the end of history with this current book, I have a sense that in your intellectual growth, you are more aware, or it's more obvious that you are aware of the complexity mm-hmm. of the evolution of institutions. Now, partly this may be the difference between doing philosophy and kind of doing historical sociology. And so, as you put these pieces together, one has the sense that you've really come to the conclusion that there. That although you can identify what needs to be there, mm-hmm. the notion that there's some magic package that could come via FedEx that would put all this together in a particular place. You no longer believe that, and that's partly what this is about.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's a huge amount of accident and contingency in historical development that explain why we get to the kind of institutions we have. It's important for developing countries because we sometimes assume, well, because Britain or the United States went through the following stages of growth, then everybody else is going to simply replicate that. And I think what you realize is that those patterns of development are actually quite peculiar, and the idea that other countries or other societies are going to replicate that is really a false expectation. For example, why do we have modern democracy today? It really has to do with the survival of a feudal institution, which was the estate or the parliament, into modern times. It didn't survive in most European countries, in France or Spain or Russia, but it did survive in England. And the reason we have parliamentary democracy today is the very specific, accidental, almost, conditions by which the English Parliament managed to survive and be a dominant force in English politics. But you can't take that for granted in other societies.
One of the virtues of your book, for somebody like me who read a lot of this comparative literature, say, in the 60s and the 70s, is that you've really added new flesh to the bones of comparative studies, that you're bringing in cases like China and India to the front. Obviously, there were area studies in the past, but these two examples were not in the middle of the work being done on the grand theorizing.
I think that there's a big problem with contemporary multiculturalism. We have to be multicultural. I mean, all of our societies are de facto multicultural, and we live in a globalized world where you deal with other cultures. But there is a kind of political correctness involved in studying other civilizations. And so the Eurocentric or Anglocentric narrative that would have been taught to American school children a century ago has now been displaced by one that looks at other civilizations. But I think that even today, they're not adequately, comparative. I mean, they really don't ask hard questions about why certain institutions evolved in certain places and they're absent in others, or what the real impact of a certain set of religious beliefs was in, the contemporary evolution of a political order.
Before we talk a little about what you have to say about China and India, I want to bring up one other concept that you bring in, the concept of spandrels, which originally emerges in biology. Explain what that is and how it helps us understand, for example, the contribution of the medieval Catholic Church.
That's right. Well, so a spandrel, there's a famous article by Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin that talked about the spandrels of San Marcos. So a spandrel is an architectural space that's created by intersecting arches in a dome. It actually isn't deliberately designed. It's just the result of this, geometrical, coincidence. But then they came to be decorated, and they came to be seen as architectural motifs in their own right. And their argument was that in biological evolution, that happens a lot of times. Things evolve for one purpose and are useful for another. And I think in the history of human institutional development, you get spandrels all the time. So, for example, the reason that the Europeans were able to exit out of clan-based kinship politics was the fact that the Roman Catholic Church saw this big opportunity by changing inheritance laws to limit the ability of tightly knit clans to keep property within the tribe, and the church did this, I think, for purely material reasons. They wanted to get their own hands on these resources, but they forbade concubinage and they outlawed divorce and all of these strategies that these kinship groups used, and the result was the emergence of a much more individualistic society in Europe at a very, very early point, compared to China or India or the Arab world. And so that was not the church didn't set out to destroy extended kinship, but like a spandrel, it just happened as a result of other intentions that it had.
And this is really about actors in historical contexts choosing a strategy so that they can succeed in terms of economic resources, mm-hmm. power, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, they follow all sorts of different motives. Some of them are idealistic ones. I mean, the church really was responsible for establishing the European rule of law, the tradition of the European rule of law in the 11th century, because it wanted to exert, you know, moral authority in Europe. But, you know, so everything is a mixture of motives, but no institution, you know, is ever simply, you know, anticipated and planned and just emerges as a result of somebody's plan. It's really a much more accidental and nonlinear process.
In your book, you argue that really we have to look to China to see the formation of the first state in the way we conceive of it today. Talk about it. What was it? What were the factors in China, mm-hmm. I think in the 3rd century yes. B.C., that leads to the first, I guess in quotes, modern state?
Modern state. Well, so it's important, the word modern. There were many states in Babylonia, in Egypt that preceded China. But China was the first society, in my view, to actually create a modern bureaucracy that was impersonally recruited, that wasn't just friends and family of the emperor. And the reason that happened was essentially military competition. The Chinese fought 5 centuries of almost unremitting warfare in what they call the Spring and Autumn and Warring States period that finally reduced the number of Chinese polities down to a single Chinese state, the beginning of the Qin Dynasty in 221 BC. And it was the need for survival in this extremely brutal and violent period that required people to be recruited on the basis of merit rather than just who was your cousin or, you know, who are you related to or who are you friends with. And so modern institutions emerge in China at this very, very early period as a result of that kind of social competition.
And what results then is the transcending of kinship ties. We've recently had on our program Anatole Levin, who has a new book on Pakistan. We had Ambassador John Campbell, who has a new book on Nigeria. And in both cases, when you look at Nigeria, you look at Pakistan, it's kinship and the resulting patrimonialism that creates many of the problems we're dealing with. Yeah. Help our audience understand, why is that transcending of those ties so important?
Well, I think that, you know, kinship, all societies go through this period where social organization is based on kinship, but kinship is very limiting. If you want to win a war, if you want, you know, the best organized, you know, bureaucracy, a lot of times it's not your relatives that can provide that. Also, kinship just leads to small-scale societies. And so the modern state was created in a way to establish a universal criteria for citizenship. Everybody in the territory is a member of this larger community, and doesn't matter what your tribe or your ethnic group is. And I think in many developing countries, the problem, you know, Pakistan is a great example of this. These modern state institutions are basically imposed on top of societies that are still basically organized according to kinship and patronage and, you know, what social scientists call clientelism, where some powerful landlord, you know, can mobilize thousands of peasants that work on his lands and vote whatever way that landlord wants. And that's not, you know, that's not modern democracy and that's not a modern state.
After the chapter on China comes a comparison with India. Mm-hmm. And you get, I think you say around 600, you get a detour, you call it, in India. That means the consequences are that India does not go the route of a powerful state. What were the differences there?
Well, I think this is a testimony to the power of ideas. It's really the rise of this Brahmanic religion in India in the millennium before the birth of Christ. You get a hierarchy established in India in which the Brahmins, the top class, are priests, and they're distinctly superior to the next class down, which is the class of Kshatriyas, who are warriors, who are the actual holders of political power. It's interesting, you know, prior to that point, India and China actually looked fairly similar. They're tribally organized. The Indians raised cattle. They were itinerant, you know, tribal groups that ate beef. And then all of a sudden, with the rise of this religion, you get a very, very different form of social organization, the caste system, which basically sacralizes the division of labor in the economy, creates a very powerful set of social constraints on political power. So to this day, the ability of any Indian state to penetrate down into a village level is limited, and no Indian ruler has been able to do this. So I think that the fact that India is a democracy, a law-governed democracy, and China is an authoritarian state is not the product of anything that happened in the last 100 or 200 years. It's not the product of colonialism. These are patterns that go much further back. No government in India has ever, other than for a very brief period of time, been able to exercise a sort of dictatorial, centralized authority that Chinese governments have routinely been able to exercise over that same 2,000-year period.
And this is the important point, isn't it, about why all this history matters, because it really informs our understanding of the trajectory of China and India today as they are in the company of the other BRICS, mm-hmm. and are changing the international economy.
No, that's right. I think that, you know, I don't want to sound like a historical determinist, because in fact, you know, countries change these deeply rooted patterns of behavior. They create new institutions, and then they veer off in different directions. But I do think that without an understanding of some of the deeper historical patterns that exist, you're just not going to understand the present. In China, for example, you know, what they invented really was a high-quality, centralized, bureaucratic form of administration. That's the thing that they're good at. They've been good at this for the last 2,000 years. They're still good at it. They're much better at it than the average, you know, African or Middle Eastern or, you know, Latin American country. And if you don't appreciate, you know, how much history stands behind that, I don't think you're going to understand the, you know, the contemporary Chinese system.
And looking at the revolution in quotes in the Middle East today, you're not going to be able to understand their trajectory, which without understanding the breakthrough that did not occur mm-hmm. in the Arab countries, the breakthrough of moving beyond kinship mm-hmm. and separating the church and the state.
Yeah. Well, I think even as we speak, you have these uprisings in Yemen, in Libya, in Jordan, you know, in Syria, and in all of those countries, the actual social organization is still based on tribe or clan or, you know, ethnic group or sect, and so in a sense there hasn't been this process of modern nation building and state building that's taken place. There are some exceptions. So Egypt clearly has a very strong, you know, national identity and sense of separate statehood. But that also suggests that Egypt's path towards actually creating a real democracy is probably going to be easier than Libya, which wasn't even a country until the Italians brought these, you know, disparate provinces of the Ottoman Empire together and said, okay, you're one country.
Huntington introduced also the idea of political decay. And you address that concept mm-hmm. today. What are the two factors that lead to political decay? That is the unraveling of these central components of liberal democracy.
Well, I think they're the sources. You know, one important source is just the stickiness of institutions. So we human beings create rules, institutions, but we invest them with a kind of intrinsic worth, either through religion or through, you know, deep historical tradition. And when external circumstances change, we don't modify them. And so we're kind of stuck with dysfunctional institutions. And in the book, there are many historical examples of this. I actually think that we may have in the United States today, you know, a little bit of a case of this, because our system of checks and balances is so effective that it's actually preventing, you know, important decisions from being being made. The other source of political decay, I think, is any time a society comes under stress and the modern institutions, you know, don't function as well. What gets reasserted? Friends and family. You know, this biological urge to, you know, as a kind of default form of social organization. And that leads to political corruption and the, you know, the recapture of the state by, you know, especially by wealthy elites.
This book, your new book, is one of a projected two volumes. It takes us up to the French Revolution, and two of the factors that you touch upon in the latter part of the book, which really change the equation, you know, in the mm-hmm. episodes to come, are the whole international relations mm-hmm. phenomena, but also economic development. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little, because now what we're seeing is into this mix, we have to add, you know, the power of international intervention, processes like the international institutions, mm-hmm. the World Trade Organization, right. and so on.
Well, globalization is not a new phenomenon. It's been going on for several hundred years. This is basically the knitting together of the world through trade, investment, you know, the movement of people, ideas. So no country today evolves in isolation. We have foreign models, we have foreign resources, we have advisors, we have the World Bank, we have, you know, USAID. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which the development of an individual society is shaped by the ones surrounding it. The other really important difference between the modern world and the historical world that I describe is economic growth after the Industrial Revolution, basically. If you look at the curve for growth, it kind of bumps along for the first 50,000 years of human history, and all of a sudden around the year 1800, it goes like this. And we've been on that trajectory, you know, hopefully we'll stay on it, but it's made the, you know, the experience of the last few generations different, because all of a sudden people are mobilized by economic growth. So you think about China today, hundreds of millions of workers coming off of the countryside, you know, lived as peasants. Now they're living in big cities, access to TV, internet, a lot of different sources of information, and their lives are just completely different. And so that really has an important shaping. It's an important shaping factor for politics.
One of the issues in our times, and with the after the fall of the Soviet Union, the emergence of the U.S. as the most powerful country in the world, is the whole question of how one can intervene in the internal affairs of countries to help them achieve the end result of liberal democracy. And I think as a result of this recent period, you've changed your thinking. An idea that reappears several times in the book is, you know, it really depends on the circumstances on the ground. Mm-hmm. There are limits to what intervention can achieve. Now, in the United States, the notion that the U.S. could intervene was really the neoconservative agenda. What have we learned from that experiment? What did you learn from that experiment? Because you saw yourself as a neoconservative, but you've broken with that tradition.
Yeah, well, I think that if you just look at the history of American nation-building efforts, first of all, we actually don't learn very much from our own, you know, mistakes. There's a kind of historical amnesia. But I think that, you know, the main lesson that emerges is that Americans are too impatient. You know, we go into Haiti or Nicaragua or, you know, Vietnam or more recently Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've got about a 4 or 5 year attention span, and we want to fix these countries and give them strong governments, rule of law in that length of time. And if they don't measure up, you know, at the end of this period, we get frustrated and then we leave. And I think that this, you know, simply doesn't appreciate the difficulty of helping countries to implant strong institutions. It is something that other outside powers can do, but it takes, you know, maybe a generation-long commitment. And I think that that's something that, you know, Americans are too impatient to really sit around for.
So a secondary purpose, in a way, of this book is to say, hey, this is really complex stuff if you're going to try to do this. And if one were to give the book to policymakers, and they should read it, I think what you're left with is the notion you do need patience. You need to have a big picture that it's not only in the sense of what's going on now, but in kind of the history of these places and actually our own history.
That's right. Yeah, Americans tend to project their own experience on other societies, and they tend not to really absorb, you know, the real context in which these things are happening. So, in fact, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I've been interested in this whole question of failed states and nation building, and what do we know actually about building institutions. And I think part of the reason that the history is important is to make people understand that this is a difficult process, but it's also one that, you know, is guided by the specific trajectory of particular societies, and unless you understand that background, you're really not going to be able to help them very much.
Are we in a situation in the United States, both domestically and in foreign policy, where what you call cognitive dissonance in the book, drawing on the whole literature on that, that we're in danger of not adapting to the change circumstances both domestically and in terms of not learning, for example, the lessons of the intervention in Iraq?
Well, I think that the Iraq case was so negative that we probably are going to learn, you know, that lesson. I think the bigger lesson that we may not learn, you know, we're just used to being a hegemonic power. We've gone through this two-decade-long period since 1989 of being the world superpower. The world is changing. We're going into a much more multipolar world in which we're going to have to figure out how to share power with other countries. And our ideas are not necessarily going to be as popular or as dominant as they were in the past generation. And that's an adjustment that I think is going to be difficult for Americans to make.
The big question at the heart of the end of history is very relevant today, because when we look at the success of China, it appears that we have a competing idea, mm-hmm, about how you bring economic benefit to the most people. It's not clear that Chinese experiment will work. What are your thoughts about looking at China and the limits of the trajectory that it's on, and how that compares with your ideas about the triumph of liberal democracy?
Well, China has got a lot of short-term advantages over a democratic society because they can make decisions. You know, being an authoritarian country, and they're pretty good at macroeconomic policy. So you go to China today and you see all this wonderful infrastructure. They've been able to invest in high-speed rail and dams and hydro and all of this stuff. And we in the United States, you know, by contrast with our checks and balances political system, are pretty much stuck in a highly polarized, you know, atmosphere in Washington. We can't make big decisions about dealing with long-term, you know, fiscal issues, health care, a whole raft of issues. I think, however, that you can't answer the question, which is the better system, looking at the short run. You have to ask, how sustainable are either of these systems over the long run? And there, I still think that our system has got a lot of advantages, because in the end, it is going to be more flexible. The one problem the Chinese have really not been able to solve is what they call the bad emperor problem, where if they've got a good group of leaders at the top, they're rolling along and you know, they're very efficient. But what guarantees that they're always going to have a good ruler? And I think that's historically been their downfall. They periodically get these terrible emperors. The last one was Mao, who can do so much damage to a society without checks and balances that, you know, I think democracies in the long run, their average performance is going to be better, because they may not get the top level performance, but they avoid the worst excesses.
What about the problem of global governance? You talk about that in the newest edition of The End of History. This book is obviously focused on the national level, what happens to states and so on. But do any of these insights apply to the problems of global governments? Clearly, we're not going to get global government, mm-hmm. but we're attempting to navigate mm-hmm. international institutions that pick up some of the slack mm-hmm. that can't be handled by the hegemon. And actually, some of what you're saying about national states apply to global governments. The question of accountability, mm-hmm. the question of rules, and so on.
Yeah. Well, we have a long way to go in global governance. I mean, basically, we're at a kind of tribal level of development with regard to global governance, where there's no sovereign that can actually enforce rules. There's no third-party enforcement. It's basically everybody's, got self-help. And I think that we're not going to get to global government. What we're going to have is some in-between solution that will create some degree of accountability on particular issues. I think we're headed towards a world in which we're going to have multiple overlapping international organizations and forms of cooperation, because I do think that a kind of single centralized global government is going to be an awfully elusive goal.
You identify in the conclusion to The End of History, new edition of the book, to the problem of terrorism, of non-governmental actors, of proliferation. Mm-hmm. What will be the best way to deal with that in the future in this world where we don't have absolute governmental international institutions, and America is seems to be losing its resolve in addressing these issues.
Well, it's messy, and I think each problem is going to be addressed in a different way. You take the problem of the international drug trade. That's something that is partly a matter of national policy. Latin America wouldn't have this problem if Americans didn't consume so many drugs. So part of it is a domestic, issue with demand. Part of it is a matter of international cooperation between police departments, between, intelligence agencies and the like. Part of it is a kind of moral question about, mobilizing publics to fight this, and money laundering and the like. But that's different in turn from proliferation or from dealing with, global diseases. Each of these, I think, needs a solution that's, that's fitted to the nature of the problem. And in a sense, that's the story of institutions on a national level, too. There isn't a global template that fits every society. These things really have to evolve based on the actual interests and histories of the actors involved.
Given your intellectual odyssey and the problems you've grappled with, what would be your advice to students about preparing for the future if they wanted to see a continuation of the field of study that this book represents?
Well, I think they got to pay attention to the world as it is. They've got to travel. They've got to open their minds. I think that one of the most important lessons for me is the one that Seymour Martin Lipset, the great sociologist, used to like to quote, to his classes, that a person that knows only one country knows no countries, basically. Hmm. Unless you get out of that parochial context, you're really not going to be able to understand your own society, because if you can't see it from the perspective of someone outside the society, you're not going to see it correctly. And so I think that's one, very important thing that students ought to keep in mind when they think about how to study and where they're going to travel and this sort of thing.
And then one final question. What would be the takeaway from this book that you would have for policymakers in Washington?
I think that it should be a greater appreciation of the difficulty, first of all, of the need for institutions, and then the difficulty of implanting them and the need for a certain amount of patience and historical perspective when they approach questions of intervention and nation building, state building, and the like.
Let me show your book again to our audience and recommend it highly, both for its coverage, its insight, and the clearness and lucidity of the writing. So thank you very much, Frank, for coming on our program.
No, thank you, Harry.
It was a great pleasure to have you.
Right.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.